Thank you. The University of Illinois, one of my employers, is part of the state government of Illinois in the U.S., which makes me a government agent. Obviously not James Bond, but you know, even if you're an insignificant little part of a team, you've got to remember teamwork. You have to remember what the team goal actually is. And in the case of the government, that's the team, let me just stop talking about me. This is about us. This is about the government. This is about what we want to do. And the team goal, even if I'm just a tiny part of that, the team goal is listening to people. You know, that's what the government does. People want us to listen. If a government doesn't listen to the people, it's not going to be very effective, right? So our goals are to understand what people are saying and to understand what people are thinking. We care. We want to know. We want to listen. We want to hear and understand the people. Now, this is something where we've, over the years, put more and more time and money and effort into doing this. And I would say, I mean, you could imagine for any government around the world, except possibly in Germany. In Germany, it's not clear whether, I mean, right now, if you look at a German interception, I'm sorry, German understanding of what people are doing, then there's a lot of technology that goes into it, there's a lot of money that goes into it, but there's not as many people as there were during the Stasi time. So I don't know whether the current German government understands the people as well as the Stasi did. But in pretty much every other country, there's been clear advances in achieving policy goal number one, which is to understand the people. Now, there's one problem that we're facing, one annoyance, which is also growing, which is crypto. And what is crypto? Well, this is, for purposes of this talk, the only thing that matters about crypto is that people who use crypto, people who follow the instruction saying, here is what to do to encrypt your communication, these are people who are communicating with each other in an incomprehensible way. They are somehow using a language that we do not understand. So that is clearly in conflict with the goal. And this is what these people want to do with crypto, and this is what we do not want them to do. So we do not like crypto. Sometimes, because people are communicating with each other in a language that we don't understand, and then those people communicate with other people, and we don't understand, maybe somehow this person's talking to that person, sometimes, maybe, we don't even know who's talking to whom as a result of a whole big network of people talking to each other. Okay, if we can understand the content and the metadata, if we're adequately tracking people's movements and seeing who's talking to that person at this moment, and we have enough insight into the content, then we should be able to figure out who's talking to whom. But if the crypto is done well enough and there's all this incomprehensible communication, then lots of times we can't actually figure out who's talking to whom. And so there's some anonymity, and that's a real obstacle to understanding the people. So as a policy matter, what should we do? There's lots and lots of options here. For instance, we could try to break the crypto or sabotage the crypto, like you heard in the previous talk. But I'd like to look at more legal kind of answers. So here's some policies we can aim for in the law. Obvious answer to the crypto problem is to outlaw it. So the American version of this is speak English. If you are communicating in a language that we don't understand, then you are doing something wrong. Well, that's not the current US law, but it is the law in some countries. For instance, Iran. If you're a so-called human rights worker in Iran, that means somebody who doesn't respect the legitimate government of Iran, and you are communicating with people using encryption, then you are violating the law, and you can be beheaded. This is maybe a little bit too extreme, but maybe not. I mean, maybe this is a legitimate policy option to consider. With or without this, you might consider another possibility, which is to go after the teachers. Now, people who are using crypto, they're following instructions for how do they communicate with somebody else incomprehensibly. And this is something where, well, instead of going after the people who are using crypto, maybe we can go after the people who are telling them how to use crypto. So there's going to be people who are giving instructions to other people. These people giving the instructions are called cryptographers. And these people are saying, they're providing instructions to the bad guys, telling the bad guys how they can speak without us understanding. Example of this is the U.S. Arms Control Arms Export Control Act. There's past tense here that this required NSA. It's no longer active for reasons I'll say in a moment. This required that before anybody publish instructions saying how to speak incomprehensibly, that person trying to publish those instructions would have to talk to NSA, get NSA to review what exactly they were telling people, and then approve it or not. And if NSA did not approve it, then it was against the law to publish it or to otherwise communicate. All right, so that's another policy option as we go after the people providing the crypto, the people providing instructions of how to speak incomprehensibly. And then the third policy option that I'd like to distinguish from these two, and you should be thinking as I give you examples through this talk of the obstacles that we're facing, you should think about how these differences in our policies are perhaps going to run into different obstacles. The third possibility here, instead of telling people speak English, or instead of telling people, don't tell anybody how to speak anything other than English, what we can do is, if we see somebody speaking French or something else incomprehensible, then we say, excuse me, can you translate that into English, please? And if you don't, then you go to jail for, say, 2 years. So this would be the, what is that, Regulation of Investigatory Powers, is that right, in the UK from 2000. Part 3 of that act says, Section 49 says that the police can send a letter to somebody saying, give us your keys or go to jail. A few people have been jailed, a few people have given up their keys. It's not clear exactly how broadly this is going to be used in the future, but it has been used to some extent already against very dangerous people such as animal rights activists. Okay. Let me focus on the US. I realize that the mapping project is a European project, but perhaps you're interested in the comparative side of this, and my entire talk is going to be about the US Constitution, as my title indicated. In the US, somehow people have gotten an inkling that we want to understand them, and they've seen some small examples of how we want to understand the people, and they've actually been complaining about this, which is kind of puzzling because this is our job. So somehow people complain that we're trying to understand them, and then the courts sometimes get involved, and the courts keep talking about this constitution that guarantees people's rights, whatever those are, and they claim that we're trampling on people's rights. And actually, the real problem here is that even though we've got all the guns and tanks and drones, somehow we still pay attention to what these judges tell us to do, which I would think is kind of a policy mistake of its own, but let's not go there. The judges keep saying that we are violating the U.S. Constitution, and we have to stop it, and sometimes maybe we pay attention to them. So this is actually a serious problem. What I'd like to do for most of this talk is give you examples of the kinds of things that these judges are insisting that we pay attention to, these rights that are guaranteed under this Constitution, which unfortunately means that the main goal that we have is something that apparently we're not supposed to do. I'll draw conclusions about this at the very end, but let me show you some of the actual problems. So the main problem is something called the Bill of Rights. So this is from 1791. After the U.S. Constitution was adopted, there were lots of objections to it while it was being adopted, that it did not guarantee people's rights. And then within a few years, the Constitution was amended with 10 amendments, which guaranteed various rights. And you can see, if you look at this from a modern legal perspective, you can see all sorts of ambiguities. It's kind of embarrassing. If you were putting this kind of stuff even in a little contract and you didn't define the words you were talking about, then of course you would be in big trouble, and there's all sorts of ways to attack these. Like, suppose you say, Congress, okay, we know what Congress is, that's the legislature, shall make no law, that's clear enough, abridging the freedom of speech. Okay, what is the freedom of speech? If you spell it out, you say something like, anything that people say, they're allowed to say, and any law that interferes with that in any way is not allowed. If you make that kind of definition, then Well, okay, that's getting more clear than the text here. If you don't make that definition, then you're allowing the opposing attorney to say something like, aha, freedom of speech, you didn't actually mean something as broad as that definition, which you never wrote down. You just meant the following, right? And so there's arguments back and forth about what these words mean, and eventually there are judges who resolve the question of what they think these words mean or what they think the words should have meant, rather than what the words actually meant. Another part of this I'll point out is the right of the people peaceably to assemble. In context, this sounds like it might be about petitioning the government, like, government, please do the following. But peaceably to assemble is separated by a comma. Does that include, for example, the freedom of association? I think in ECHR Article 11, there's explicitly a freedom of assembly and a freedom of association. Here you just see a freedom of assembly. And again, it's up to judges to decide whether this actually includes a freedom of association. And in the US, they did decide that. More and more problems for us. Another amendment, which I'll draw attention to, is the Fourth Amendment to the US Constitution. There's two parts of this. The first part says, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And then the second part says that any warrants have to particularly describe the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, okay, anybody looking at this, you can see that the words are not the same between the first part and the second part. The second part is saying, if you want a warrant, then you need to particularly describe what you're going to be searching or seizing. The first part says no unreasonable searches and seizures, but that does not mean no searches or seizures without a warrant. I'll get back to that point later. Something else I'll briefly mention is the Fifth Amendment, which includes various things like no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. Well, what if there's not a criminal case? What if it's just a civil case? Or what if there's a regulatory matter that you're telling somebody to file some information? There's no criminal case. Is that a problem? Or, nobody's supposed to be deprived of liberty without due process of law. What is due process? And actually, if you look at the commas carefully, then you convince yourself that the due process should also apply to that being compelled to be a witness against yourself. I think there's also some self-incrimination protections in Europe, except in the UK, which finds itself immune to European human rights law. I think I'll briefly mention the 14th Amendment. You might have noticed when I was saying Congress, this is just the federal legislature. There's also state legislatures and local towns and so on. There are restrictions starting after the US Civil War. So I think this was adopted around 1870. After the U.S. Civil War, a lot of the protections in the Bill of Rights were also applied to the state governments. I'm not going to get into a lot of that. Let's just treat the government as one big monolithic entity. We are the government. Let's not worry about whether it's state or federal. Okay. I'd like to give you a few examples of how the judges have interpreted these unfortunate provisions of the Constitution to interfere with our trying to understand the people. And let me start by making a procedural point about how annoying the judges can be. There is a concept of having judges reviewing what's going on, judges monitoring, watching what's going on. For example, suppose that you have like classic wartime censorship, or during any international emergency, surely you should have some sort of censorship where people aren't allowed to just say anything. By the way, in the US, we've been in a continuous state of emergency for more than 100 years, according to US government official declarations. A prior restraint, this is what it's called in the US law, a prior restraint, by definition, is a censorship system where before you publish something, you have to send it in to a censor. That's the prior part. Before you publish, you send it to a government censor, and the censor tells you, yes, you're allowed to publish, or no, you're not allowed to publish. That's what a prior restraint means. Now, there's this really annoying decision called Friedman versus Maryland from 1965. At that point, the US had film censorship, and a filmmaker went all the way up to the Supreme Court after refusing to submit his film to the censors. Now, the censors said, hey, we would have allowed that film through, but the law says you have to submit the film to the censorship board, to the state censorship board, before you can show anybody the film. And, well, the Supreme Court looked at this and said, all right, whatever we think of films, which they were still figuring out at that point, if you want to have any sort of prior restraint, then we don't like having a censor deciding whether something's allowed, whether a communication is allowed or not. The only people allowed to decide whether you're allowed to communicate are judges. So this case said, if there's a prior restraint, then there has to be a procedure, specified procedure, which includes a judge making the decisions. So here we have judges saying that judges are the only people allowed to make decisions. Totally self-interested job security here for the judges. The judges say the judges have to make these decisions of whether the content is protected by the First Amendment or whether it's banned for some legitimate reason. The censor, the person who's refusing to say, yes, you can publish this, has to prove that it's not protected by the First Amendment. The censor has to guarantee adversarial proceedings, so there's lawyers for both sides, and there have to be specified brief time limits. For instance, a few days or a week is even pushing it. It's something much faster than your usual judicial procedure. So the judges have to drop everything else they're doing. The censor has to drop everything else he's doing. And if these procedures aren't in place, which they weren't for the state of Maryland, then you just cannot have a prior restraint system. So it's a procedural requirement from these judges saying that you're not allowed, we are not allowed to censor things. Which, of course, is really annoying. For instance, remember that U.S. Arms Export Control Act that I mentioned, which said, before you tell anybody how to use encryption, how to speak incomprehensibly, you have to get approval from NSA. Well, that sounds very much like what happened in this Friedman versus Maryland case. It's a prior restraint, and it certainly doesn't have a judge making the decisions. It has NSA making the decisions. It certainly doesn't have burdens of proof and time limit. It doesn't have any of the procedural protections. And certainly the content that is being censored here, namely instructions to people of how they can communicate incomprehensibly, that is protected by the First Amendment. So this is unconstitutional. It's in violation of the Friedman versus Maryland procedural protections where these judges are insisting that they be the only people who can review whether content is protected or not. There are a few cases which establish this. One of them is a series of decisions in a case by somebody named Bernstein, and then there's a Younger versus Daly case. The Younger versus Daly has the fact that instructions are protected speech. I should comment that if you're reading the court decisions about these things, people will sometimes complicate the crypto story by tossing in computers and diskettes, and it all sounds very complicated. But in the end, there's multiple decisions that instructions are protected by the First Amendment, which is not an obvious thing. I mean, come on, do we actually want to allow people to publish instructions of how to build a nuclear bomb? Come on, this is pretty unreasonable. But this is what these judges say, is that instructions are freedom of speech. Very strange. And then this Bernstein versus U.S. case drew the conclusions from Friedman versus Maryland that the NSA requirements were unconstitutional. Now this, I should say, these were not Supreme Court cases because as these courses were winding their way through the appeals process, for other reasons, we wanted to win the 2000 election, so we kind of gave up on these NSA reviews of crypto. There was enough pressure from Silicon Valley. I mean, money does matter. You know, we've got job number one, which is to understand the people, and part of that understanding is where your donors are giving you money. And if enough people tell you don't censor crypto, then, well, you don't really have a choice. But, okay, this is an example of the kind of constraint that we run into, that, again, judges are not simply trusting us. Judges actually want to make the decisions. Even there was a decision just yesterday about whether the NSA interception of all sorts of data from all sorts of people in the US is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, which I'll get to in a moment. Well, I showed you the Fourth Amendment. I'll show you a decision about it in a moment. even in this case where there's all sorts of reasons for the judges to think that they're not competent to make decisions, the judge in that case insisted on doing his own review of everything the government was saying. So we really have these judges watching over our shoulders all the time. And this, I mean, I don't know if you can appreciate how frustrating this is. It's somehow incredibly traumatic to have this feeling of constantly being watched. I mean, we're just trying to do our jobs here, and these judges are making us feel less than human. But, okay, that's the situation. Then lesson number two about this procedural constraint is that what you should notice from all these rules is that it's the Freedman versus Maryland rules are triggered by having us make a decision rather than judges make a decision. And that's something where if we had simply said from the beginning, you're just not allowed to talk about crypto. First rule of crypto is you don't talk about crypto. Don't ask us for permission, just you are not allowed to say anything. That would not have been a prior restraint. It would not have triggered this procedural question. And then that would have actually been allowed, at least under this case. So we should have just banned crypto. All right, suppose we try to get back to goal number one, and we're trying to listen to people, we're trying to understand what they're saying, and in particular, we want to start by collecting all their communications. Then we run into this little problem of the Katz case. Now, Katz was a wagerer. He was somebody handling gambling for people, and he made some telephone calls about his illegal gambling activity from somewhere in New York, I think, to somewhere in California. And there were some heroic federal agents who had prepared for this. They thought that he was going to do this. They planted an interception device, an eavesdropping device, to listen and record his conversations on the outside of a telephone booth that he had been seen visiting before. They turned on the recorders, and they caught his conversation. And, of course, we don't bother going to judges for everything. Look, nowadays, judges, they can see a warrant request on their iPads and sometimes get back to us in 15 minutes, but that's still a hassle. If we had to have 15 minutes for every specific search of somebody's information that we want to carry out, we would never be able to get our jobs done. So, of course, this was not carried out with a warrant, but then the Supreme Court said that eavesdropping does, in fact, require a warrant. There's a quote here saying that the Fourth Amendment requires adherence to judicial processes. Searches conducted outside the judicial process without prior approval by a judge or a magistrate are per se unreasonable under the Fourth Amendment, subject only to a few specifically established and well-delineated exceptions. Remember, there's a requirement for a warrant to have certain information. There's a prohibition against reasonableness. And the annoying default that's being set up here is that a search is unreasonable unless it has, a warrant, or it falls within a few exceptions that the judges have recognized. If there's going to be a warrant, then it has to have precise limits from a specific court order saying what to search, what to seize. This has to be after detached scrutiny by a neutral magistrate. Again, these judges are just constantly watching us, really annoying. And then after the search happens, there has to be a report back to the magistrate saying everything that we've searched, everything that we've seized. And, all of this certainly did not happen in the eavesdropping in the Katz case. All right, so this obviously is a problem for us, since this is really getting at our fundamental policy goal here of understanding what people are saying and hopefully understanding what they're thinking. We can't do this if every time we collect information about people, we have a judge having to watch the specific thing that we're collecting. It just totally prevents us from scaling up to understanding the whole population, which is the goal. Now, I said there are some exceptions. There are some cases where the judges have reasonably allowed us to collect information without a warrant. And let's look at an illustrative example of one of those exceptions, which is that if we arrest somebody, then the cop who's doing the arrest can search that person. Maybe that person has a gun hidden in his pockets. Maybe that person has some evidence of a crime, which he's going to destroy if we don't immediately search him and grab the evidence and take it away from him. Or he's just going to hide it. So it's important when we're arresting somebody that we search that person and go through all of the stuff that he's carrying, maybe even stuff within reach. We've managed to convince judges of this, so judges are not totally crazy. Whew. And then once we have an exception like this, the judges have recognized that it's too complicated for them to evaluate in every case whether we were actually looking for hidden weapons. So they have a rule that says we can search anybody that we arrest. And then they say the motivation for the rule is hidden weapons or concealing evidence, but the evaluation of whether we're looking for hidden weapons or for evidence that might be destroyed, that's not relevant to the rule. The rule says we can search anybody incident to arrest. Excellent. Once you have a rule like that, let's start taking advantage of it. The rules of the game have been set. Even if we're doing what the judges tell us to do, let's see how far we can push this. Let's arrest somebody, and hey, this is the modern era, let's search his cell phone and open it up and start flipping through it and collect all the information. That gives us some pretty good understanding of this person. Anybody who's skeptical about this, please give me your cell phone just for a few hours. I'll give it back to you afterwards. It's fine. And then, of course, the question of are we allowed to do this only when we arrest somebody? We can come up with all sorts of excuses for arresting people. So we'll arrest more and more people, get their cell phones, which have more and more information. At least it's a plan. At least this is something we can do. But then the annoying Supreme Court comes back in, and they have this Riley versus California decision, which is so recent it doesn't even have an official page number there. In the U.S., you're supposed to leave these blanks when you're doing citations, legal citations, so that somebody can go back and scribble afterwards what the right page number was, and then eventually the official published opinions have page numbers. So it'll be some page in volume 573 of the U.S. Supreme Court reports. I actually have a more read to you from this decision to give you an idea of how crazy these judges are. here we go. A warrant ensures that the inferences to support a search are drawn by a neutral and detached magistrate instead of being judged by the officer engaged in the often competitive enterprise of ferreting out crime. Well, yeah, it's competitive. We have a job to do here. In the absence of a warrant, a search is reasonable, compliant with the Fourth Amendment, only if it falls within a specific exception to the warrant requirement. And now, here's where it gets totally crazy. The Fourth Amendment was the founding generation's response to the reviled general warrants and writs of assistance of the colonial era, which allowed British officers to rummage through homes in an unrestrained search for evidence of criminal activity. Opposition to such searches was in fact one of the driving forces behind the revolution itself. So here we have the United States Supreme Court taking perfectly legitimate British activity of trying to stop crime, and they're advocating revolution. This is the United States Supreme Court advocating revolution. Just crazy. And then they say at the end, modern cell phones are not just another technological convenience. With all they contain and all they may reveal, they hold for many Americans the privacies of life. They put that in quotes, the privacies of life. The fact that technology now allows an individual to carry such information in his hand does not make the information any less worthy of the protection for which the founders fought. Here, again, the U.S. Supreme Court is advocating revolution, unbelievable, against a legitimate government. And then, well, they finish this off by saying, our answer to the question of what police must do before searching a cell phone seized incident to an arrest is accordingly simple, get a warrant. Okay, that's the kind of problem that we have to deal with. I do have a couple more slides on a couple more examples of the kinds of problems that we're facing from these courts, and then I wanted to finish off with some conclusions about how we can try to get around these judicial decisions. Very briefly, privacy of association. So this is from the First Amendment via the 14th Amendment, to some extent the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment also showed up in this other case. First one here was about the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which did not want us to know its membership list. And that's pretty important for us to understand who's a member of which organization. That's the most important way we can make judgments about people, is to understand which organizations they're a member of. And if they are, for instance, a white person supporting rights for black people, we need to know that. Similarly, if somebody's in support of communists, we need to know that. Now, the distinction between these cases was that the case about the NAACP was viewed as being indisputably lawful activity, whereas the case about the communists, being a member of the Communist Party, was, from various laws from the 50s, viewed as being illegal activity, which is why the first part went on about freedom of association for lawful purposes. The second one was about self-incrimination. And the conclusion from both of these cases was that we're not allowed to just get membership lists. Even if we say, oh, we haven't brought a criminal case yet, you just are required by tax law or business law or whatever to give us a membership list, we're not allowed to do that. And there's, again, some fascinating quotes from the Supreme Court about how, for instance, inviolability of privacy and group association may be indispensable to preservation of freedom of association, particularly where a group espouses dissident beliefs. And the U.S. Supreme Court is saying this as if that's a good thing. Dissidents are not a good thing. Dissidents are trying to put us out of power. And the most important thing for us is power. That's the whole reason for trying to understand the people. Last slide on the kinds of court cases that we're facing. Tally versus California. I said that sometimes crypto is preventing us from even understanding who's communicating with whom. And sometimes people are even able to distribute information anonymously. Now, this case, Tally versus California, somebody was violating a perfectly reasonable law which said that every leaflet distributed in whatever town in California had to have the name of the person who was responsible for the leaflet. And obviously, if we're going to stop people from sending around fraudulent leaflets, we have to know who is sending them around, so we want them to put their names on it. What the Supreme Court said in saying that this violated the First Amendment, that the law violated the First Amendment, they said that anonymous pamphlets, leaflets, brochures, and even books have played an important role in the progress of mankind. Persecuted groups and sects from time to time throughout history have been able to criticize oppressive practices and laws either anonymously or not at all. And they keep going like this in the decision about how the old seditious libel cases in England show the lengths to which government had to go to find out who was responsible for books that were obnoxious to the rulers. We don't want obnoxious books. John Lilburn was whipped, pilloried, and fined for refusing to answer questions designed to get evidence to convict him or someone else for the secret distribution of books in England. Two Puritan ministers, John Penry and John Udall, were sentenced to death on charges that they were responsible for writing, printing, or publishing books. Before the Revolutionary War, colonial patriots frequently had to conceal their authorship or distribution of literature that easily could have brought down on them prosecutions by English-controlled courts. Along about that time, the letters of Junius were written. Junius was one of the main people responsible for, he was a demagogue, convincing these colonies to rebel against the legitimate British government. And here we have the U.S. Supreme Court just, again, totally advocating revolution. And they say at the end, the Federalist Papers written in favor of the adoption of our Constitution, that was after the Revolution, were published under fictitious names. It is plain that anonymity has sometimes been assumed for the most constructive purposes. So, okay, you can see that we're not on the same team as the judges. All right, what do we do about this? There's a public relations issue. We have to get these judges understanding the importance of what it is that we're doing. I've got just two slides on this and a picture, and then I'll stop. Main thing that seems to be useful is to point out how bad the users of crypto are, how bad communication is, especially if we don't understand it. So what we can do is say those people who are communicating Tor, for instance, Tor is child pornography. In fact, Tor is drug-dealing terrorists who are having sex with your children and distributing films of it on the internet. These are bad, bad people, and we have to stop them. Anything that we can't understand is certainly going to be something bad. For instance, something obscene like pornography, maybe copyright violation. This is how we get Hollywood on board in making sure Hollywood also wants to stop people from communicating incomprehensibly because Hollywood wants to make sure there's no copyright violation. Or false information, fraud. You don't want to support fraud, right? You don't want to support conspiracy to commit terrorist acts, people plotting revolutions. So, okay, we've tried a lot of these arguments over the years, including in some of these cases, and unfortunately the Supreme Court doesn't seem too receptive, except terrorism. Terrorism has turned out to be, of all the bad things that we've pointed to, this seems to be the most productive work. At least, well, maybe not quite at the Supreme Court level. It takes a while for cases to get up to there. But at least for lots of lower court judges, we say, terrorism, 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 and the judges become very, very compliant. They do very much what we want them to do. They join our side, even if they weren't, according to the previous decision. So we've managed to get rid of warrant requirements, due process requirements, things like no person shall be deprived of liberty without due process of law. Most people would say that means you can't just walk up to somebody and shoot them if you're the government. And, well, we've managed in terrorism cases to get rid of this requirement. We can just blow people up. We don't even have to walk up to them, which has some personal risk. We can do it as a video game and send some drones around and blammo, and then even US citizens we've managed to blow up because they're terrorists. That's what we say anyway, or they're supporting terrorism. As soon as we use the word terrorism, then the judges become compliant. Except there's a plausibility problem that we're facing, and I don't have a solution here. The problem is that we've been caught again and again doing things where we say that our goal is to fight terrorism, and actually, of course, we have much broader goals than that. For instance, we've been spying on World of Warcraft. We've been spying on Merkel. I don't think anybody believes that Merkel's a terrorist. We've been spying on Airbus. This was from many years ago. And we actually admitted that one and said that, well, yeah, that was for preventing Airbus from fraudulently getting a contract that should have been gotten by Boeing. We've been spying on Petrobras, the Brazilian oil company, and so on and so on and so on. So even though, of course, we're trying to stop terrorists, we're doing many more things. And the judges are becoming increasingly aware that we're doing many more things. So if we keep saying this is all about fighting terrorism, then we have a plausibility problem, and the judges, well, maybe the worst part of this is that we've been caught taking supposedly terrorism tools, anti-terrorism tools, and using the information we collect there to feed into drug cases. So we tell the drug enforcement agency, hey, we've noticed that somebody is dealing drugs on this corner, somebody we don't like, why don't you go find them and make up a story for the judges of how you found this. This is called parallel reconstruction. And this has been now documented, and judges get pissed off when we actually are lying to them. So I think there's a credibility problem here, and I don't know a way around this. I think this is something which we're really at risk of losing our main public relations weapon, which is the word terrorism, if we're consistently getting caught doing many things beyond fighting terrorism. This, my last example here is just a picture of somebody who was spied upon. This is a person who was constantly advocating illegal activity, engaging in illegal activity himself. He was arrested validly 29 times. He was, after a career of advocating illegal activity, he was near the end of his career before somebody shot him. He was advocating opposition to the war. He was strongly believed to be associated with communists. Obviously, these are reasons that it was totally legitimate for us to spy on this person for many years, and many other people like the actress Jane Fonda. But this particular person, Martin Luther King, was obviously a legitimate subject of our espionage, and obviously this doesn't have anything to do with terrorism. If you've got any ideas for what we can do to convince judges that it's all about terrorism and they should just get rid of all these old court decisions about people's privacy and anonymity and so on, then I'm listening. Again, we're always listening. We care. Please help it happen. Thank you for your attention.